We've been waiting a year now, but finally, the Defence Investment Plan appears to be in sight. So this time on SITREP, we want to get you ready for when it lands. From sixth-generation data-driven tech through heavy metal to the very basics like bullets, which services need what and how much will it cost? Because if, as we suspect, there isn't enough money for everything, there will be gaps. Mike and former MOD insider Matthew Saville explain what's on the table and what could be on the chopping block. And we'll look at some of your thoughts on whether we need to make big choices between our three armed forces.
The Prime Minister has been very clear that the Defence Investment Plan will be published before the NATO summit.
Treasury ultimately hold our purse strings, so they are highly, highly influential.
Defence explained.
There is a danger that we see the Defence Investment Programme as about giving equal sweeties to each of the children.
This is SITREP with Kate Chabot and Professor Michael Clark.
You said last week, Mike, it would be humiliating for the Prime Minister to go to the NATO summit in 5 weeks' time if the Defence Investment Plan was still unpublished. I don't think he listens to SITREP. But this week, we're told the PM is determined it will be published before then. It's crunch time, isn't it?
Yes. This Defence Investment Plan has been coming out next week for several weeks. Every week it's next week. But it looks now as if it may well be next week, if for no other reason that the Japanese Prime Minister is in London, Mrs. Takahashi. All the information is that the Japanese have been very annoyed with Britain over the Global Combat Air Programme, GCAP, which is the new sixth generation aircraft being procured jointly with Britain, Japan and Italy. And the Japanese have been very tough on this. They've been very annoyed that Britain has not put in the commitment, the financial commitment, early enough, and that the programme has been stuttering in the next phase. And the information from Tokyo is that they're not interested in any stopgap announcements or short-term announcements. They wanted a complete programme to take the whole thing forward properly in the way that was originally planned. And it was said that the Japanese Prime Minister would not be coming to Britain if that commitment was not made. And she is coming. I'm not quite sure the dates for next week, but she's due here next week. And so I think next week is the time when we will finally see the Defence Investment Plan.
That is a very interesting piece of information. Thank you for bringing us up to date on that, Mike. I don't want to disappear down a rabbit hole of focusing on money, but can we run the numbers quickly? Because they're important for the context. The reported gap between the total of the original shopping list and the budget is £28 billion. The Chancellor has reportedly offered an extra £15 billion, so potentially covering just over half the gap. That's across 4 years. In the context of an annual defence budget of £60 billion, that looks like a 5 to 6% shortfall. That's the boss's maths, Mike, not mine. Do those numbers match your understanding, though?
Yes, generally. I mean, if the gap is £28 billion between now and 2030, then you'd be looking at something like a 10 or 11% increase in defence expenditure to make up that gap in the next 4 years. And this looks like something like a 6% increase. So it's maybe halfway there to what would be required. And in general, I mean, if we're talking about a 12 billion settlement, which is what the Treasury initially offered, then we are definitely talking about cuts. Mm-hmm. If we're talking about an 18 billion settlement, which is more than the Treasury may be offering, we're talking about deferrals and delays. And if it's 15 billion, if that's the figure that turns out to be the real figure next week, then it's a mixture of cuts and deferrals and delays. And we still won't get to 2030 in good shape.
Okay, let's bring in Matthew Saville, Director of Military Sciences at the RUSI think tank. Before that, he was a senior policy official at the Ministry of Defence. Good to see you again, Matthew. How serious is this moment for the armed forces?
Good morning. Well, I think it's very serious because the reality is that the Strategic Defence Review laid out, if you like, a menu of options. And the things that the review authors thought the armed forces should be doing to be transformed to meet the demands of future warfare. But there was very little in the way of detail in there in terms of costs, targets, anything that really maps out the pathway. And the Defence Investment Plan, bluntly, is the bit that makes the Strategic Defence Review strategic, because it applies the means, the resourcing to that approach. Mm-hmm. And so without it, there is this huge uncertainty about what the pace and scale of transformation looks like. And we've heard enough now from industry that they need the certainty provided by the dip, they hope. So this is crunch time. And I think we're not starting from a great place, because the fact that it has taken over a year to produce it does not suggest that we're in a healthy place in terms of agreement on the necessary funding. I mean, there are lots of caveats around the figures that we've mentioned, because we just don't have good data on what the state of defense actually looks like in terms of the equipment plan and other associated issues.
Okay, so let's go through service by service and look at their needs and their wants so that we can see the options on the table. The Army arguably have the longest, but perhaps not the most expensive shopping list. What's on it, Mike?
Oh, well, we know what's on the list. I mean, how much of it they can have, we're not sure. But I mean, and the list will grow because they're still conceptualizing the sort of transformed army they want. But I mean, the Land ISTAR program that we spoke about, I think, last week is extremely important. The whole deep fire program to create deep fires and substitute for some of the things that they, you know, we can't rely on the United States for the future. The drone program, the land mobility program. They'll still want to think about the numbers of their heavy equipment, so the heavy metal, Challenger 3, Boxer, Ajax, and it may well be those numbers might be brought down a bit, but arguably they should be taken up a fair bit. There's an assumption, I think, that the Army won't increase in numbers. We're not looking at expanding the Army to, you know, 85, 90 or 100,000, so that it'll still be an army of 70-something thousand if it doesn't have to be cut. It's that sort of thing. But the Army's got a long way to go because it came from behind, in the sense that, you know, the Navy and the Air Force recapitalized after 2010, but because of Iraq and Afghanistan, the Army was the last to recapitalize, which could be an advantage in the long run, but it's got the most to do.
Yes, I think, as Michael says, that the Army is the service in greatest need of change, I think. And we're sort of talking about them as individuals. Of course, in theory, what they are supposed to be is part of what is known as the integrated force. So would have in old money been the joint force. But broadly speaking, they're all supposed to be developing their capabilities such that they can increase their output as a coherent joint force operating across all environments. But the reality is that for the Air Force and the Navy, the challenge is adapting the large systems they've got and augmenting it. And that's where they have questions about, first of all, their stockpile depth and adding to the platforms. You know, this is where using the term platform is probably appropriate in terms of uncrewed vessels or aircraft on what they've got. The Army is stuck halfway through already changing what it wants to do, and really radically having to think about whether or not both its concepts and equipment is fit for how it will fight in the future. Added to that, the Army is the case where we have made what might be seen as the most ambitious commitment to NATO in terms of the forces that we will provide to it, in that we have struggled to deploy a division, you know, maybe up to 15 to 20,000 people in a coherent fighting force. But the government has made a commitment to say that in the event of a major crisis that calls for the activation of the NATO defense plans, we will actually provide what's known as a strategic reserve corps. And we have a corps level headquarters, the Allied Rapid Reaction Corps. But deploying that size of force, which could be between 30 to 45,000 people, would basically mean deploying the totality of the current British field army. And there's no way we could do that with the kind of depth that we wanted at the moment. So the challenge that we have set ourselves on the army is the most ambitious relative to the forces that we have.
And Matthew, if the army had to make hard choices, what would be at the top of the list of what needs to be bought for them and what would be at the bottom?
Well, the big thing that they want to do is improve what is in jargonistic terms known as lethality. But what that means is a combination of their sort of firepower and ability to actually inflict damage on a given adversary. Yeah. And the path that they have taken under a project known as Asgard is to say we want more sensors and more, if you like, cheap munitions to augment our expensive crewed vehicles, such as that we can spot the enemy faster, process targets faster and then strike them more rapidly, ideally at a longer range. And so what they are looking at is a combination of more sensors further forward, which will probably be uncrewed, drone-based, either ground vehicle or small flying aircraft, and then lots and lots of relatively cheap munitions, some of which will be artillery, but some of which will also be drone-like guided weapons to improve their firepower. Now, they've tested that at the brigade level, but what they need is the volume of those sensors and weapons to be able to do that at a larger scale. Because, again, the ambition set out in the SDR is at a certain point, they will be, as it calls it, 10 times more lethal. That's an incredible increase in both processing power and striking power. So I think it's going to be a lot in terms of sensors and weapons to make that vision a reality.
Yes. I mean, it goes to, as Matthew said, I mean, the SDR talked about lethality and mobility, transformation and reserves. Mm. If we have to get to a warfighting posture within the next 5 or 8 years, then we've got to do much more on the reserves. So, you know, that's not an equipment issue as such. It has some equipment implications, but it is an issue for defense investment, that's for sure. And so I would add reserves to the list of all the things the Army is trying to do, because it's got to make itself transformed and then capable of ballooning upwards, you know, to at least core level warfighting capacity and all the other things, in addition to deploying a fighting core to NATO, all the other things that the Army might have to do in the event of a war, other expeditionary things and other things in relation to homeland defence.
Let's move on to the senior service then. And Matthew, what is on the senior service shopping list?
Well, the Navy's challenge, and I would add in the Royal Fleet Auxiliary, is that at the moment they have a shipbuilding programme, and that is bringing things into service. But at the moment, it's not going to happen as quickly as they would like it and in the numbers that they would like it. They also have, frankly, a personnel and if you like, a broader resources and logistics problem. And a brief diversion that I would say is that for all of the services and across the forces in the dip, one of the big questions will be not how many ships and tanks and aircraft are they buying? It's where are they investing in infrastructure, training, personnel, background, logistics, munitions, all of those sort of things that enable them to run and sustain the forces. But for the Navy, it is how do you actually improve your readiness, get more capability out the door onto the high seas and operating and sustain it? The answer that they are betting on at the moment is something they're calling the hybrid Navy, which is a core of their classic crewed vessels, be they submarines or surface ships, aircraft carriers, destroyers, frigates, augmented by more use of uncrewed vessels. But that's quite a variety in terms of the type of those vessels. So there's everything from very small, essentially boats, that are sensors or that could do things like mine hunting, up to what they're talking about, small ships that are uncrewed, but might be 100 meters long or something. They might be in the order of hundreds of tons. And that is in part a reflection of the reality that you cannot easily accelerate shipbuilding for big things. And if you can't train and recruit, you can't crew those big ships. So they are making do with what they can. There is a lot to test in that concept, because the engineering challenge of operating on the high seas with uncrewed vessels is not a small one.
Yeah, and the issue is always that, you know, you would expect about a third of the fleet to be available at any one time, and a third of the fleet to be ready to go to sea, and a third of the fleet to be in maintenance of one sort or another. And we've got to be able to speed up that cycle so that you can get two-thirds of the fleet to sea if necessary and the other third be ready to take over. I mean, the problem is that we just about make the one-third at sea, just about, but the other two-thirds are not ready to go as quickly as they need to be for all of the reasons that Matthew mentioned, all the backup things. The one Navy project which I think must be or will be funded is the AUKUS project, you know, the attack submarine project with the United States and Australia. That is going to become something of a sacred cow, and it might be quite an expensive sacred cow as time goes on, but there are reasons to stick with it And so I think there'll be funding for that. But the issue will be, you know, with frigate replacement, with the Type 23s, are we still going to replace them one for one? Mm. It looks as if we're not. And, you know, and the issue is that ultimately you've got to have ships. There are all sorts of modern technologies, but you've got to have vessels at sea, whether there's crew on them or not. Mm. And we're suffering, there's a real diminution, not just of the numbers of platforms, but the availability of platforms on a short-term basis.
And Matthew, on submarines, the Defence Review had talked about up to 12 new AUKUS attack submarines. Could we live with fewer?
Well, I mean, we have been living with fewer, but it's been incredibly awkward. And we've had periods when we had no submarines deployable. The submarine force is under enormous pressure, and that is partly as a result of very slow production. We lost the skills to build nuclear-powered submarines of all types, and therefore there was an industrial argument for continuing production in some kind. The number of tasks they can fulfill is more than we have deployable submarines. So we use them for intelligence gathering, special forces activity, anti-submarine warfare, protecting our deterrent, long-range strike with cruise missiles, you know, and generally being part of a deployed carrier strike group or as part of the force. And we just haven't had enough. And again, this is a tale of both people, but also dockside support infrastructure. Never mind that by the time that we finish the last of the Astute class, it will have been, I think, 20 years since construction was started on the very first of that class. Well, we built the entirety of the Trafalgar class in one decade in the 1980s, and that was a slightly larger fleet. So we have basically got worse at submarine production, and we need to get better. I mean, that's why AUKUS is so important, because the flexibility and utility you get off a nuclear-powered submarine that can therefore go long distances, can do a lot of things, and is a very capable platform is enormous. So that really matters for both the Navy and our partners, the Australians, in terms of looking at the Indo-Pacific.
Yeah. And we shouldn't forget as well, Kate, the Dreadnought program, I mean, the nuclear program, is sacred for all sorts of reasons, and Dreadnought will have to go forward. But of course, it's a national priority. It's under the mega projects system, whereby, you know, the Cabinet Office and the Treasury apply the National Infrastructure Authority's mm-hmm. discipline to it. But that also is really important to the Navy, and making sure not just that the new Dreadnought class are there, but again, they've got trained crews, that they've got the engineering backup to make it work properly. The current force, the Vanguard force, is really stretched. It really is. I mean, it's still performing its function. It still provides us with continuous at-sea deterrence. But most of us would say just about. It just about manages CASD. Just about.
So what is the priority for Navy spending, and what is bottom of the list?
Oh, I think, bottom of the list probably is going to be the replacement of frigates. I'm sure they will be deferred. I think that's probably what will happen. But top of the list has got to be Dreadnought and AUKUS. I'm sure about that.
Let's move on to the Royal Air Force then. Let's go through the RAF shopping list. Matthew, do you want to start?
Yes. I mean, the start point here is that the RAF is in a reasonable position in terms of having Typhoon as a capable aircraft, although it's taken an incredibly long time to develop and add weapons, and the F-35B model. Now we've finished the first order, so that's 48 minus the one that fell off the carrier, and a very capable aircraft. The issue it has is, where do we go with crewed aircraft? What are the weapons that we are fitting on them? Their big question will be, can we get more weapons types on the existing aircraft that we have got that give us, you know, longer range and more of an ability to go after protected, very sophisticated defences? And then, can we get more of our aircraft actually out onto squadron active service? Because the Typhoon force is not that huge. The F-35B force is pretty small. They want to train more pilots and actually have essentially more stuff up in the air. They have lots of questions about the air transport side of things, And then airborne surveillance. Again, their question is, are we making the right bets in terms of our airborne sensors in order to make best use of the weapons that we've got? In and amongst that will be the question about where do we use uncrewed aircraft, known variously as autonomous collaborative platforms or collaborative combat aircraft, but the things that go alongside us on which we might put weapons or we might put sensors. Essentially, how do we develop the force to make the most of something that at its core is sophisticated but small?
Mike, what else is on the RF shopping list?
Well, just in terms of programs, the medium helicopter is very important to the Air Force, and that's been in, had a lot of question marks hanging over it for a while now. And the other comment I'd make is that we talked about GCAP earlier on, the Global Combat Air Program. That's important, and I think it was identified in the SDR. It's not just important to the Air Force, it's important to the whole technology of sixth generation warfare, because the GCAP program is leading our sort of technology of robotics, which matter to the whole of the armed forces and to other parts of British industry. And so that collaboration on the GCAP, the Edgewing Alliance between BAE, Leonardo and Mitsubishi of Japan, those three big defense conglomerates are leading on robotics. And robotics in GCAP will not just, in theory, produce the aircraft, we hope, by 2035, we hope, but will also lead cutting-edge technological revolution in the application of robotics in sixth-generation warfare. So it goes far beyond the Air Force, the importance of the GCAP program.
Which brings me neatly on to the things that are going to span all services. Matthew, what else?
Well, there is something that the SDR called the digital targeting web, which is not a capability. It is, broadly speaking, an approach to moving data and information around the system such that the forces are more networked and can make better decisions more rapidly.
Big piece on it on SITREP here, Matthew.
Indeed. And we've got a project at RUSI on it. And that is because that is one of the main things that underpins the effectiveness of the forces. I mean, old hands like Michael will recognize that sounds a lot like a capability from a quarter of a century ago called network-enabled capability. But the principle is basically the UK armed forces are not large, and we do need to work out how we bring in more disposable, cheaper capabilities to augment our mass. But at the heart of the way that we think we will continue to fight is, can we make better use of information to make better decisions more rapidly? Because that way we can deal with adversaries who might have an advantage of us in terms of sheer numbers. So the digital targeting web is a huge thing, because that's essentially an attempt to link up as much of the armed forces as possible, and then ideally link us up with allies so that we can make use of those systems. So digital targeting web is huge. As I've said, I think there needs to be an enormous investment in basic infrastructure and training. So logistics of all kind of types, can we move stuff around? Spares, our ability to sustain ourselves in the forces, all the enabling capabilities. I mentioned the Royal Fleet Auxiliary earlier. That is in part a personnel issue about pay and conditions. If you do not have a Royal Fleet Auxiliary, they are classed as civil servants, you do not have a long-range deployable Royal Navy. Bluntly, you've got to skip from port to port because you don't have at-sea replenishment, resupply, medical, all of that sort of stuff that the Royal Fleet Auxiliary provides. Space, an enormous part, you know, part of the digital targeting web, part of our broader networking capability, an area where the UK is now playing catch up, because for years we made enormous savings from being linked in with US space-based capabilities, be those surveillance, early warning, all of the geospatial information. And that was a great saving of billions and billions. But the reality is that we need our own sovereign capabilities. We've started launching our own military surveillance satellites. We had a communications network, but there's probably more investment needed there. And so there's lots of the background stuff that mean that the pointy bit of the forces can actually operate is where we need this investment.
So, Mike, if something's got to give, what's it likely to be?
It'll be timing, I think. I mean, nobody's going to say we'll drop this capability or that capability or we can get by without it, but it'll go onto the back burner. And so certain things will stay on track and other things, I suspect, will be delayed. But we don't know by how much until we know what the figure is. And so, as I said before, I mean, if the figure is, say, 15 billion over 4 years, then quite a number of things will move to the right. If it's 12 billion over 4 years, then there will be cuts, I would think. And 18 billion over 4 years was still, it was the very minimum that the MOD thought they could get by with. They'd get by on 18 billion and stay more or less on track for the SDR. And it looks as if, you know, between Downing Street and the Treasury, it looks as if they're going to split the difference and call it 15. And so a lot of things, a lot of programs, and I suspect in the land area, I suspect that a number of systems will move to the right, not the network-enabled capabilities, but the hardware and the numbers of vehicles and the upgrades. I think they'll move to the right. They won't be cancelled, but they'll have 3 or 4 years added onto them, which means they'll cost more in the long run.
Is there anything else, Matthew, you think could be moved to the right?
I mean, I do think you might see a lot of early retirement of capabilities. And my assumption, so first of all, I mean, there's a lot we just don't know because the MOD hasn't produced good data and details for several years in its equipment plan. But my assumption is that the £28 billion figure comes from what happened if you didn't cut anything and you invested in all the things that we wanted that were in the SDR. So integrated air and missile defense, for example, which I think is vulnerable because we haven't got much at the moment. In theory, it's a high priority for deterrence, but it's difficult to make the case now because people will go, oh, is there really much of a threat? Let's push that off. So I think that £28 billion figure is what if you don't retire stuff early? As you move down the scale, then you might see more of the frigates retired early because they're on their last legs anyway. As Michael says, I think you might see slimy slicing of something like GCAP and kind of push back the frankly quite ambitious start date. You might see the purchase of future F-35 because, of course, at the moment, the aspiration is still to have 138 to give us a certain number of squadrons. Maybe that will be delayed. The problem there is that it does make things more expensive down the line. That's what happened with the aircraft carriers. They were slowed down. It's what happened with the submarine program. And I think the big thing to watch out for is actually the split of the spending if this detail is given. This is a little bit of like government nerdery, but there is both resource and capital spending. And capital is like your one-off costs on bringing something in, steel components when you're procuring something. Resource spending is your personnel costs and your running costs. Mm. And if you don't have enough resource spending, then it doesn't matter if you buy big boxes of metal, you can't run or operate them. And so one of the things to look out for is the money front-loaded onto capital spending, but it turns out we can't run these things, or we don't do much in the way of exercising or operations, because that would be a trap.
Well, ultimately, this is about delivering the military capability that the Defence Review said we need. But I just want to pick up on two key phrases from that review. NATO first, and finite resources mean the UK cannot be everything to everyone. So the big picture question, do we need to admit we can't do everything we might want? Is it time to focus our resources on capability in one domain, even if that means reducing in one or more others? Mike?
Well, yes, we know we can't do everything, and the SDR made that pretty clear when it was published a year ago. But I think it's not inconsistent with the NATO first idea, because we know we've got to look after our neighbourhood. We've reorientated our thinking about defence in the last few years to what we should do with NATO and as part of our commitment to our allies, which is very much in our own interests. And the idea that NATO is changing and we've got to live with the United States that has a very variable commitment to NATO and maybe might disappear altogether in real operations, that's a possibility we never thought we'd have to face. So I think when we say, what can Britain do? I think we should shape it around what we commit to do for NATO, which is, in theory, to provide a core-level ground force as a third echelon strategic reserve. And by third echelon, you might need to deploy a third echelon quite quickly. We're not talking about 3 months in. We might be talking about 2 weeks into a battle. But third echelon ground forces and then to look after the North Atlantic. And I think they would be the strategic priorities which the defense investment plan should try to reinforce. If we can divine a strategy behind it, in my view, that's what it should be. And that is a choice of doing less and concentrating more on what, not just what we should be good at, but what we really need to do first.
And Matthew, you were nodding there when Mike said what we commit to do for NATO.
Yes, I think this is the issue, that we have set ourselves a bill that is in tension, which is that our geography and what we are good at suggests that we should be focusing on providing high quality, we're talking about an integrated force, but predominantly maritime and naval forces that look to the high north, the Atlantic, and that means good airborne strike and surveillance capabilities, anti-submarine warfare, naval forces, the commando force, all of those sorts of things, looking predominantly north and to the Atlantic. But what we've told NATO to redress past imbalances, and we are going to make a commitment on land forces. And that's what's stretching it. You know, the army needs significant investment to meet that ambition, and that is going to stretch the available resources. So the government would say, we said NATO first, but not NATO only. But I do think that the NATO first really matters. And, you know, the reason I haven't talked at length about some of the longer term capabilities is because that also means dealing with approximate threat that you want to deter over the next 5 years, let's say. And so what you need is stuff you can get into service in that near term, not because Russia's about to invade Europe, but because you actually want to deter its ability to do so.
Now, we mentioned a couple of weeks ago, Rosie Laden had been examining the idea of prioritising the Royal Navy, and we asked for your thoughts on that. Red Beardy on YouTube writes, absolutely agree, Navy and RAF are key, with the Army small but well-equipped. We aren't a continental power, so we don't need 500 MBTs, but we do need to defend the North Atlantic and our subsea infrastructure, Mike.
Yes, I mean that's in what we're saying. Mm. The army will be small, but we want it to be small and lethal and useful as a strategic reserve. But yeah, I mean the North Atlantic, Northern Europe, that being our neighbourhood, that's predominantly a Navy and RAF requirement in the way that Matthew's just outlined, I think. So I wouldn't disagree with Red Beardy there, but it's not that we don't need an efficient army. We do, of course. But as you say, Red Beardy, the army will be small, but it must be well-equipped and it must be capable of providing some sort of strategic reserve ground force.
I mean, I would agree with the principle. I think that the issue is even that small and capable force will require a lot of investment, and it's not really acceptable if you're, particularly from a European perspective, if you're looking across at the UK, still the third largest defence spender in NATO, and for us to say, well, we could just about deploy like a good brigade. You know, the reason we've set ourselves that target is because we reflect that there needs to be some kind of UK land commitment in order to demonstrate solidarity, but also to play our part in the NATO defence plans. You know, the details of those are, you know, classified. But what you don't want Europe to think is that the UK is just going to sort of sit there as an island and be like, well, we're okay. So we have set ourselves the target of playing a role across a certain number of defence plans. And yes, that means a heavy focus on maritime and air, but we have said that we will play our part on land as well.
And there is one other point about this case as well. If you remember, in the old 20, 30 years ago, we took pride in the idea that we did a bit of everything in NATO. Every role that NATO performed in the Atlantic, in the high north, in the Mediterranean, on the central front, in the air, we did a bit of everything. And we thought that was what we were destined to do, as one of the founding powers of NATO. Well, that's not the sort of NATO commitment we can make anymore. So now we say, look, let's make a more limited but important NATO commitment instead of trying to be there everywhere within NATO, which used in the good old days of the 60s and 70s, when we did literally every job that could be done in NATO, there was some British contingent doing it.
An NSW Lancer on Instagram says, it's a stupid idea and one that gets raised all the time. Wars are won in the land domain. They always have been and always will be. Is it still true, Matthew?
It depends on what you're trying to achieve with your war. I mean, it's slightly, if you are taking territory, you are at the moment, you are putting people onto that territory. I mean, I know that this is being tested in Ukraine and there, you know, there's an increasing growth in the use of uncrewed ground vehicles. But one of the things that even the, you know, the Russians and the Ukrainians are finding is that you can create opportunities with a range of weapons. Ultimately, your breakthroughs at the moment come from people moving onto territory, whether they walk, drive, or are transported or dropped. And I do think, though, that to speak to the reader is like, yes, wars, if we're fighting a war with Russia that ultimately is about them taking territory, the land component will be decisive there. But the defense plans might say something about who is providing that land component. There are good land forces across Europe. You know, the Poles have been massively beefing up their armor. Turkey has a huge army. Number of others, particularly in the Baltics, have got very effective ways of approaching ground incursion. We're back to what is it that the UK said it will provide in terms of a ground commitment? But our main role on day one could be air and maritime. It's just about how we are feeding into those commitments.
It also, Mike, it depends on what the enemy are trying to achieve with their war, and they get a vote.
Yes, that's the whole point. The enemy always gets a vote, and the need is not to have very elaborate plans that can't be changed. I mean, that's what happened in 1914, of course, war by timetable, when the Germans had a very elaborate Schlieffen plan that they found it impossible to change, and they couldn't adapt quickly enough to the things that happened in those early months of the war. So you need a system that you're confident is adaptable enough. And so you can say, yes, we'll do this and this, and we won't do that, that, and that. But in the realm of this and this, like maritime and air in the Atlantic and a ground component as third echelon somewhere in Northern Europe, we can be infinitely flexible in the way we apply them precisely because the enemy will have a vote and wars always begin in ways that are not quite anticipated.
Now, Pontimin 4173 on YouTube writes, the priority should be 1. Nukes. Britain needs a fully independent nuclear deterrent, and it needs to be a lot bigger to show current and potential enemies such as Putin, Trump, Xi, etc., that we mean business. 2. Drones, because they're taking over warfare. And we haven't talked about the nuclear deterrent that much. That really chews up our defence budget. But is it money well spent, Matthew?
Yes. I mean, it's the ultimate insurance. Let's be clear. There is a debate going on about the effectiveness of European deterrence. I should say, when we talk about nuclear costs in the UK, and when we last had data, it was about 40% of the equipment plan, and maybe at certain points in the coming decade, 20% of the defence budget. That is the totality of the nuclear enterprise. So that is not just Dreadnought, it's Trident, but it's also the acquisition and running of the nuclear-powered conventionally armed attack submarines. It will be AUKUS. It's the atomic weapons establishment. It's the disposal of all of the old boats. The UK still has, tied up alongside, every single nuclear-powered submarine it has ever operated, because we're still in the process of dismantling them. So it's tremendously expensive. The deterrent is there to provide a contribution to European and NATO security alongside the French, although we each do it in different ways. There has been talk about, should we augment the deterrent? I think the reality of the nuclear debate is that what we actually need to do is fill in the gap beneath it. So we have this top level insurance, which is if we face this major threat, and our nuclear doctrine is a bit ambiguous about how severe that threat is in order that it adds to its deterrent capability. But what we then have is this big drop down to our kind of standard conventional deterrent. Mm. And one of the things that Europe is investing in across the board or researching is long-range strike capabilities, or deep precision strike, as it's called. And that can be ground-launched hypersonic missiles, which are therefore very difficult to intercept because they're very fast, or things that just have an incredibly long range. And that is because if you basically give the impression, well, you don't want to threaten our existence because we'll nuke you, the adversary might think, well, but what if it's just a little bit of a threat? You're not going to risk nuclear war over a lower level threat, and you can't really hurt us enough because you lack these longer range, heavier hitting weapons. And so that's one of the reasons why we're involved in multiple research projects on basically ground launched cruise missiles of various types. So I think that, you know, the deterrent plays a role in our doctrine, and we need to think about, could we augment it? But actually, we are back to, how do we improve our conventional deterrent so we've got more of that range of different scales of threat covered?
And do you remember, Matthew, in the Kennedy era, Robert McNamara, flexible response, and the NATO policy, 1964, we're going through the same arguments again. I mean, not that there's anything wrong with the arguments, it's very important. At different levels of technology, we're back to the idea that deterrence requires a full spectrum in order to work, no big gaps.
And does that mean then, Mike, that our nuclear deterrent at the moment is less of a deterrent than it once was?
No, it's a national deterrent. It's a weapon of last resort, and it is a genuinely minimum deterrent, but it is a fearsome deterrent, because if one of our boats fired all of its missiles, then 40 missiles will go towards, let's say, Moscow, and whatever Moscow does to try to prevent them getting through, most of them will get through. That is a fearsome deterrent, fearsome. And so as a national deterrent, that's still there. Even if the boats are clapped out, we assume that the missiles will work if the button is pressed, or the key is turned, I should say.
Okay, let's move on to another comment. This is Patrick Kobe 2183 on YouTube, who says, this whole idea about tough choices is all wrong. What the UK needs to do is stop wasting its military budget on procurement blunders like ordering 5 sets of radar for 3 AWACS, or wasting £400 million on upgrading the Warrior IFV only to give up halfway. No more blaming the system instead of the people making the decisions. Everyone talks about saving money. Nobody ever seems to deliver it, do they? Is it always a lost cause? Could it be the answer now?
There is definitely a lot to be said for fixing procurement. Although military procurement is difficult, very few people get it perfectly right. There's enormous waste in the US system. They just have more to throw at the problem. The French get a very good return on their procurement, but they have lots of gaps because of where they have prioritized. So the UK could definitely spend its £65 billion at the moment, rising to over 70, although that does include operations. And if you're in the Treasury right now, you are probably saying, well, hang on, you just got an increase in your defence budget, just spend that better. I think it can both be true that the MOD needs to get better at spending its money, and it is looking at procurement reform again, but that the only way through the current challenges is more resources, because the alternative will be quite severe cuts that take years to reverse. I would also sound a note of caution. We have twice in the past 15 years or so included, alongside defence spending increases, assumptions about making efficiencies in the system, as they are known. And if those are wildly optimistic, they are problems. So specifically, the 2015 National Security Strategy and SDR did increase the defence budget after the big cuts of 2010. And there was a lot of praise for more money going into defence. Those were accompanied by what the then Chief of Defence Staff had later admitted were heroic assumptions about efficiencies. Mm. And the problem was they couldn't make the savings in backroom and people and costs, running costs, which meant that there were de facto cuts. Basically, our eyes were bigger than our stomach. So we put more into the equipment program in particular than we could save through efficiencies. And that meant that a few years later, we were back in trouble on defense spending. So yes, definitely there will be an expectation that we can do better on defense spending. But if the assumptions are, you can have, let's say the answer is you can have £15 billion, and then hidden away in the small print is the MOD will make savings of £6 billion.
Yeah.
Like the assumption would have to be like, well, you can't assume you've really got 15 billion because you can't guarantee you can make those efficiencies. I think there's a real risk of a trap there.
When Philip Hammond was Defence Secretary, I remember sitting in a meeting with him when he said one time, he said, there's no, and he was a business person. You know, he used to call him Spreadsheet Phil. And, he said there is no reason why an organization cannot make 3% efficiency savings every year, regardless. 3% efficiency savings every year. But by the sort of logic of that, after 30 years, you're not spending anything at all.
Mm-hmm. Mike, the Financial Times is reporting today that the Treasury wants to take control of spending on the next generation of RAF fighter jet, the Global Combat Air Programme we mentioned earlier. Could that help?
Yes. The system is really important. I mean, we're looking at maybe 6 billion. It looks as if it's speculated up to 6 billion is earmarked for the programme, and it will be very important. As we said before, you know, GCAP is important not just in the aircraft it should deliver, but in the technologies it should kickstart or help to mature. So that, I suspect, will be money well spent. But I know that the Treasury worry that the GCAP system is the next HS2. You know, they regard according to commentary, they regard the MOD as delinquent when it comes to spending money. And the shadow of HS2 hovers over the Treasury at the moment for very good reasons. And so GCAP, I think, is brought into that category of projects that might run completely out of control and not deliver the goods.
Finally, a comment from Mark Pemberton on Facebook, who says, aircraft carriers are about power projection. We can defend UK and defeat the Northern Fleet with aircraft and submarines and defend our vital sea lanes with smaller surface vessels. If we want to project power and fight on NATO's borders, that means boots on the ground, army boots. If we're specialising, we should do so without carriers. And as an aside, we can't do anything without manpower. Matthew, to you.
Controversial one, because you know I was responsible for the policy for the carrier strike group deployment in 2021. And I'm a big fan of the utility and the flexibility that aircraft carriers offer you. But there is an argument that if you're going for a NATO-first approach, the utility of the aircraft carriers, which are still there, is reduced. Do you definitely need them? And I think the problem there is that the aircraft that fly off the carriers at the moment, the F-35B, has an incredibly limited weapons fit. So it's all very well saying we will push the carriers out. You need to defend them. And at the moment, that would require almost the totality of the deployable Royal Navy, because you would want to put air defense destroyers and frigates and your submarine around it to protect it. And then at the far end, at the moment, your F-35 is flying off it, and then it can fire air-to-air missiles or it can drop bombs on a target. The F-35 has no standoff weapons for ground attack at the moment. And that's because the Spear 3 missile is delayed for integration. It's several years away. And we've just, I think, made a deal to get more, if you like, glide bombs, which will give it some range, but they're not on it yet. So if you want to have a specific discussion, like, yes, the aircraft carriers are very vulnerable if you decide to make very hard decisions around prioritizing European defense. I think what the Navy would say is, that's why we're going to experiment with uncrewed aircraft being launched off the carriers, because then you're back to, maybe you could do anti-submarine operations from a carrier. Maybe you could do different strike operations. Maybe there'd be a great surveillance platform. But there is a challenge there for the Navy in, have you configured yourselves around an expeditionary capability, the ability to go a long way and strike something with Navy power, right when the Navy is now shrinking? And what you really need to do is be absolutely top-notch on area defense and anti-submarine warfare.
Mike, do you want to add to that to answer Mark's points there?
Not really. I mean, it's an argument that we've had since the carriers were put into the plan in the SDR of 1998, because the Navy takes a globalist view, saying, well, the Navy's there to extend Britain's global role and do all sorts of good and useful things. If we take a more North Atlantic view, carriers have less relative utility. I mean, carriers are a great system, but if you're working in the North Atlantic, if you say to the First Sea Lord, would you rather deploy a carrier or would you rather deploy four frigates and two destroyers? I know what the First Sea Lord would say.
Well, thanks for all your comments. And if you do have more thoughts or indeed questions, you can always email us. We are sitrep@bfbs.com. Cards on the table. What are each of you watching for when the dip does get published, Matthew?
I am going to be a nerd, and I am going to be looking for the level of detail and the breakdown it provides on 10-year spending and investment. And I think I will be interested in that split between resources and capital. So before I'm even looking at ships and all those sort of things, have we actually got the money to sustain the forces? And I think big questions on stockpiles, infrastructure, the support network that enables us to improve the readiness of the forces that we have now and will have over the next 5 years. So I think I am slightly less interested in the what are we going to buy 10 years from now? It's what does it say about near-term readiness and I think the transition to maximizing our firepower and output. So not just munitions types, but also the use of uncrewed that can be brought in soon, networks, digital activity, all of that sort of thing.
What about you, Mike? What are you watching for?
Yeah, I mean, I absolutely go along with that. What looks as if it's being funded for the near term as opposed to the midterm. I think that's a very important pointer. And the other thing related to that I'd be looking for is how much is going on the transformational systems and how much is going on trying to make good all the deficiencies in our present force structures. And so, you know, and there's a worry out there that too much of it will go to, as it were, the traditional legacy systems and the legacy companies, and not enough to the transformational and the new procurement ecosystem, which the government wants to try to develop. And it'll be interesting to see if there's real detail in it, if you could make it, if, you know, people like me are able to make a judgment. I don't know if I can or not. But, you know, reading it and analysing it, will we be able to say that 30% of this is going on transformation and 70% is on legacy? I mean, would it come down to something as basic and simple as a judgment like that?
Probably if not. Anyone can make the judgment, it's you, Mike, or you, Matthew, really. So this time next week, you reckon, that's it. We're going to be out of our misery, or maybe the misery just starts then.
Different sort of misery.
Yeah, all right. We'll be peeled, keeping our eyes peeled. Thank you both of you so much for your time today. It's been really fascinating. Matthew Saville and Professor Michael Clark. I'll be back with another SITREP next Thursday. And as of this week, there's a new way to enjoy BFBS SITREP, the podcast, as well as listening. You can watch us on YouTube. You'll find us on BFBS Forces News Channel to see on the screen of your choice, whether it's your phone on the go or casting to your TV while you're on the sofa. So we'll see you next time. For now, though, from me, Kate Chabot, thank you for joining us. Bye-bye.